Welcome to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast with your hosts, Richard Hill and Matthew Darlitz.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. My name is Matthew Darlitz, Editor-in-Chief of the Science of Psychotherapy magazine, and I'm here with Managing Editor Richard Hill. Howdy, Richard.
Hi, Matt. Fantastic. Here I am, and really looking forward to part two of John Dowling today. This is terrific. I've had the good fortune to be able to listen to this a couple of times. So much good stuff in here. And I guess all I can do is say I can't wait. But what else have we got going on at the moment?
Yes, Richard, I'd just like to remind people again that on our wonderful Academy site, that's thescienceofpsychotherapy.net, we've got this wonderful course, Therapeutic Applications of Neuroscience, Psychoneuroimmunology and Epigenetics by our good friend John Arden. And this will take you through a lot of what John has been talking to us about in the magazine and in our podcasts with John, and this is an accumulation of many years of his work and wisdom, and so I would encourage you to jump onto that one.
Yes. Which fantastic! It seems, Matt, that our problem is that our name isn't John. So John Arden, John Dowling, Joseph Ledoux was almost a John.
Okay.
So we'll do a bit of deed poll and changing, and that might improve our intelligence. But for now, let's go listen to part two of Professor John Dowling. Well, I was always fascinated by the discussion years ago. A friend of mine who ended up becoming a medical professor, and rather brilliant. But she was saying with antibiotics, this is just sort of giving the comparison of a medicine, because we have natural antibiotics within, of course. But she said the antibiotics only actually deal with about 25% of the bacteria, and your natural systems do the rest. But that's the 25% that kills you. And using the medications is the one that just brings the patient back from that little bit of excess that sends them, well, as we call, you know, in the colloquial term, crazy.
Mm. Absolutely. I mean, no question about it. So, you know, I have a stepdaughter who is a cognitive a clinical psychologist. And so we spend a lot of time talking. She's quite fascinated right now about the addiction that teenagers have for their cell phones.
Yes, right. Yes.
They've been writing on this topic. She might be someone you might be interested in having on the program at some point.
Oh, that would be wonderful. Yes.
Oh, I'll put her in touch with you. But she's making this sort of a very important aspect of her career. She's in practice, but she goes around to schools and talks about this addiction, which I think is a real addiction. It's a real problem.
You
know, as I drive around Harvard, you know, I see these kids with the earphones, so they're tuned out there. They're looking at their cell phones, crossing the street without looking either way, and I'm so afraid I will hit one of them one of these days.
Yes.
But it is an addiction.
Yeah,
and addiction is one of the biggest problems that our society is facing right now.
Well, it's exactly as you're saying, by understanding the neuroscience, that these influences have a modulating effect on the way the brain functions. Exactly what the modulating effect is requires, you know, further research. But if people's behaviours are changing, and those mechanisms, those cell phones and doing that, does seem to change behaviour, that has to have, just because of the nature of the system that we've got, that there will be modulations, there will be things happening in the brain that are different because of this stimulus. And this is a bit what you talk about in the nature of how behaviour can be looked upon as expressions of brain behavior, as sort of, you know, the you know, behavior as to brain activity is what I meant.
Yeah. It's coming back to the point that I was making very early on, and that is that sort of everything we experience is changing the brain, and one has to be careful that it doesn't change it in negative ways. And addictions, of course, do that. We know pretty well today the major pathways that get activated when people are addicted to something. We know that there is a group of cells in the midbrain, and the ventral tegmental nucleus, VTA, and that projects to the nucleus accumbens in the forebrain. What does that release? What do those neurons release in the forebrain? Our old friend dopamine.
Yes, exactly. Indeed.
Yeah. And you know, the basic science work we did in the retina on dopamine is beginning to have some impact in our understanding of exactly what dopamine is doing to those cells. A neuromodulatory pathway again. How to deal with it? I mean, I think, you know, when I teach my freshmen and we talk about drugs and how do we deal with drugs, you know, that it's interesting how they respond. You know, many of them think that we should make drugs freely available. And I sort of think that we should be moving in that direction to some extent. That is, that where drugs we get into real trouble is when people are addicted, they need the drug, they have to go onto the street to get it, they don't get a clean drug, and it also costs a lot of money, which brings them into crime. And I always point out that, you know, during the Vietnam War, we had a number of soldiers in Vietnam that became addicted to various drugs, including cocaine and even heroin. When they came back to this country, many of them, not every one of them, but a great majority of them, were able to get rid of the addiction.
Yes.
Something that we don't see happening when we take people off the street, put them in rehab, they then fall back into the situation where they have the, you know, the great desire for the drug again. Why? What's different between the veterans coming back from Vietnam and the people in the environments that encourage drug use? It's an environmental issue. And that, again, right, is something that we need to come to grips with. How do we change the environment? If drugs were more available in a controlled way, would that be a better way to do it? I'm not saying that I know the answer, but I would love to see it tried. I read in the paper, I think just today, that Scotland, I think it's Scotland, is opening in one of their major cities a place where addicts can come and get pure drug so that they're much less in the way of overdose problems. And then they're worked with by the professionals in that setting, but it doesn't cost them anything for the drug. And I'm going to be very interested in how that experiment works.
Yes, I think so. There was that, because that interesting aspect, going back to the framing as we've been doing about the nature of the way the brain is modulated. And so the environment in Vietnam modulated the brain in such a way that taking drugs seemed to be a good idea. At home, there are people who the environment is modulating and creating effects that make drugs. But interestingly, as you say, for those Vietnam veterans, the way in which the environment at home impacted and affected their mental processes was different and didn't take them towards drugs. In fact, took them off the drug. And so that environmental impact. Yeah, we've done quite a few experiments looking at gene expression through just things like talk therapy and meditation and a few other. And that's looking, again, supporting this idea that you've put forward for so long, that there are modulatory impacts that occur within the neural network. And understanding this is going to give you a great deal of strength and confidence in the work you do is what I'm picking up. That's the message I'm getting from this.
Going back to something I said earlier, I want to emphasize the point that, you know, when I started talking about the enkephalins and the placebo effect, what I didn't say, which is important to say, is that the largest group of substances in the brain, in terms of numbers, are the neuropeptides. Yeah. And we know extraordinarily little about what they do. The enkephalins, the endogenous opiates, we do know a lot about, but many other substances that we know are released from neurons, we don't know what they're doing. And I think this is going to turn out to be a very useful area in which to put significant resources and research.
Yeah.
So again, I think it's a point worth making. And again, encourage those who are trying to treat mental illness with psychotherapy, which I think is incredibly important, need to keep an eye on so that they understand more of what's going on in the brain. One more thing of what's... Oh, I'm sorry. Ask the question, please.
Oh no! I was just going to say on that point of what we don't know. Near the end of your book, you talk about the future and speculating about moving forward. Now, I just wanted to get a little bit of your take on what you're envisaging. Where are we going with this science in the near future?
Well, I think where we're going, when I started my career. And was really one of the early neurobiologists. Certainly, I was the first one at Harvard on the main campus. And of course, I had my friends in psychology because I was interested in vision. But psychology in those days was a very different subject than was neurobiology.
Yeah.
I mean, too many of my psychology colleagues treated the brain as a black box.
Right.
And you put input in and look at output and so on and so forth. But what's going on inside the brain? That was what I was interested in. And today we're beginning to get at that, particularly through neuroimaging. That has really fundamentally changed psychology. And indeed, as I mentioned very early on, I just today got back from Paris, where I was at a short meeting. And heard an absolutely fascinating talk. And let me tell you a little bit about it, but it shows what's going on in psychology and the things that we just couldn't have imagined. But again, the basis for this has been the imaging techniques. Now, one can criticize the imaging because you're not looking at neuronal function, but it does tell you where things are happening in the brain. And that's terribly important. And this was a lecture by a man by the name of Stanislav Dehaene, who has been studying how to learn to read. And what he's discovered is in the inferior temporal cortex, which is where we know that there are neurons that respond to very specific objects. The first example here was the discovery back in the 70s. Of neurons in this area of the brain that respond selectively to faces. This was done by Charlie Gross here at Harvard, a friend of, a classmate of mine. Anyway, to make a long story short, what he's found is that there is a small area in the inferior temporal cortex which seems to be selective for letter recognition.
This
in youngsters before they learn to read, and the area is not there. Once they learn to read, it is there. And again, children who are dyslexic oftentimes will not show the word recognition area. Although we could talk more about dyslexia and what's going on there. But this was fascinating. Then he went on, and this is what really now is beginning to bring together the neurobiology and the psychology. After identifying this area, he then, with his colleagues, began to record from individual neurons in the word recognition or the letter recognition area. And what he found was that there are some neurons that would respond selectively to just a single letter.
Wow. Wow.
Others that would respond to two or three letters.
Mm.
And one would guess that there may even be neurons that are responding to selective words.
Right.
And I think it may be analogous to the face recognition system, whereas it's known for maybe 40 to 50 years that there are neurons in the inferior temporal cortex that respond selectively to faces. Now it's been shown that it's just not one area, but six or maybe even eight different areas, all of which respond selectively to faces. But one area looks at one aspect of a face. Another area will look at a different aspect of a face, i.e. how far the eyes are apart, how broad the forehead is, and so on and so forth. So that the notion that indeed how we recognize somebody that we're familiar with is those various areas all looking at an aspect of face and putting it all together, so that the old concept that were there grandmother cells in the cortex may turn out to be right.
Right.
Idea that a cell would respond selectively to one's grandmother seemed far-fetched.
That is amazing.
No, I was just going to say, because it's interesting that I think it was just a few years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, I think it was Harvard, but that they did word research and they looked at the activity and they found that of word stimulation, and they found activity globally throughout the brain. The words were grouped with associative frameworks and certainly as in brain activity that was occurring at the time those words were put forward. You know, whether they're stored there or not is a secondary word.
That's a fascinating question. We now, you know, the whole business of memory and learning, which I talk about a bit in the book.
Yeah.
And that is we understand the beginning of how a memory is consolidated, but that's then where our information really ends. We know that memories aren't stored, for example, in the hippocampus, where the initial consolidation of memories occurs, but they end up all over the cortex stored. But how that happens, when that happens, and what's involved, we really still have very, very little in the way of understanding.
So the big thing, I suppose, when we're saying about what's happening in the future is a lot.
Yes, absolutely.
The theme that I started to get at, and that is we need now to put together cognitive neuroscience with neurobiology.
Yes. Right.
Do groups of neurons, something I said earlier, interact to underlie behavior and ultimately cognition? And, you know, we have nice little examples of the way it may work. Another one that's always been a favorite of mine is, rationality. How does one make a rational decision?
Right.
And what has been pointed out, particularly by, what's his name now? I can almost see his book from where I'm sitting, but I can't. But anyway, that people with flattened emotions, that is, that have lost the areas in the forebrain that are involved in the correct expression of emotions, if they become damaged, then they have trouble making rational decisions.
Ah, yes.
This is way back to the famous case of Phineas Gage. Absolutely. Who lost those frontal lobe areas. But then there are examples of where people have had tumors in these areas and they have lost the ability to really have emotional experiences. So when they have flattened emotions, what is the case is that they don't make rational decisions. Usually we think of emotions getting in the way of rationality, but it's just the opposite. Unless you have a stake in something, you don't think it through.
Yeah, and this thing of meaning, it's actually a subject that I work a lot with curiosity at the moment, and And I'm very interested in curiosity for information, which we're all very familiar with. But it's this curiosity for meaning. I think meaning is a drive. You know, is one of our seeking drives, because it gives us this greater quality of life. And certainly, just in the title of your book, when you're saying what makes us unique as human beings, but understanding the brain gives us that framework of dealing with us as human beings as different from some of the other species who have their own specialities, but we have ours. And this is what the book seems to be really bringing together from a very fine point of technicality up to these broader aspects where you talk about consciousness, you talk about emotions, which are terribly important in understanding. But what were you feeling when you were writing the book and bringing these ideas together? Is this what you do when you get to a point of understanding that you get to?
Well, you know, I a lot of it came from teaching. As I mentioned very early on, I was really the first neurobiologist here on the Harvard campus. There were neurobiologists over at the medical school, but neurobiology, now we call it neuroscience, was thought mainly to be a medical school topic. That's something that would be of great interest at the undergraduate level. But when I came back to Harvard, as a full professor, this was 1971-72, I decided to start a course for freshmen and sophomores, students who hadn't had too much in the way of college sciences yet, to introduce them to the ideas of how does the brain work, what do we know about it, and so on and so forth. But, you know, as you start teaching this and the students start asking questions, you obviously want to know and start trying to find out how the information that I was teaching in those days, which was mainly neurobiology, how individual neurons work, how that extends to the larger area of neuroscience. And of course, today, with the imaging techniques that we now have, we can begin to combine together neurobiology and cognition, so that we're making great progress. But we have a very long way to go. There's no question about it. But, you know, that we're beginning now to see higher brain function in terms of neurobiology is, to me, very, very satisfying and exciting.
Yeah. So you've been a pioneer from you know, the very beginnings here, and yet there's still a lot of space for a lot of pioneers to come yet to learn a lot more.
Sure, there sure is. And, you know, when I started off in teaching the course, calling it behavioral neuroscience or behavioral neurobiology. We didn't have the word neuroscience. It was behavioral neurobiology, with that emphasis that if we could understand more about the underlying neurobiology, then we would have a chance at really understanding more about behavior. And I put a lot of emphasis in those early days on the work that had been done that I mentioned earlier on in invertebrates, simpler nervous systems, where the cells were larger, which enabled you to make recordings from them that you couldn't do very well in mammalian brains, and fewer neurons and so on and so forth. And, you know, some of the early studies in invertebrates, when Hartline, who won a Nobel Prize, showed how Mach bands, a psychological phenomenon, could be explained by a simple inhibitory circuit in the eye of a horseshoe crab. I mean, who would have thought that horseshoe crab analysis would be very useful? But every organism we know shows lateral inhibition and that enhances, in vision anyway, edges and borders and so on and so forth. I mean, I still love to teach it because it's so simple and everybody can understand it. And then, of course, the marvelous work that Eric Kandel and Jimmy Schwartz did on aplasia and the gill withdrawal reflex. It really set the stage for our understanding of how we consolidate memories. Yep. I mean, it's still, you know, that basic, those basic ideas have held up all of these years. And again, you know, Eric won the Nobel Prize for that work, and deservedly so. It was tremendous. Now we're beginning to pull apart things in the human brain. We're beginning to get notions of how we can recognize faces, how we can read, and things of that sort. Very exciting things to do.
Yeah, it's a very exciting field, a very exciting future ahead of us. Yes. Professor Dowling, we're probably coming to the end now of our podcast, and I just wanted to thank you so much for giving your time to be here with us and to share some of your insights, and we'll especially be letting everyone know about your book, Understanding the Brain. Are there any last final thoughts that you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, I probably have too many.
Yes, I could imagine that, but there's been so many wonderful gems along the way, John.
Yes, well, it's really fun. I so much enjoy, you know, talking with people about what we now know about the brain, but then emphasize how much we don't know. But, you know, every day, I mean, I was so exhilarated after hearing that lecture on Wednesday by DeHaan on how we read and, you know, the components. I mean, clearly the story is not complete by any matter of means, but that there is a little area there in the inferior temporal cortex which the neurons respond to single letters or pairs of letters or more complex situations, and I'm sure we're going to find out that there are probably neurons that are responding to specific words that we're using all the time.
Yeah. No, thank you, John. We have enjoyed it enormously.
And we will let everyone know about this wonderful book, Understanding the Brain from Cells to Behavior to Cognition. Thanks again, Professor Dowling.
Oh, you're very welcome. I hope it was coherent. Great. Okay.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, fantastic. Wow, Richard, Professor Dowling really was one of the founding giants of all of these different discoveries in neuroscience. It was such a privilege to have him on the show.
And just like we've found with so many of these absolutely fantastically brilliant guys, they're all sitting there saying, and now what? And look what's coming. And there's so much more. I mean, how extraordinary. And we hear this over and over again. My greatest, most touching thing from Ernest Rossi, my mentor, when he wrote to me and he said, be better than me.
Right.
And it's just this invitation from these wonderful people who've touched the genius to say, okay, you guys, keep it going, keep touching, keep going, keep making it happening.
Yeah.
So it's very exciting. We've scratched the surface.
Okay, so let me just remind the listeners here that we've been talking about John Dowling's book, Understanding the Brain from Cells to Behavior to Cognition. And in this book, it's broken into three sections, and he talks about cellular neurobiology, the nuts and bolts of how our brain works. And then he takes us on to systems within the brain. And then finally, we get to cognitive neuroscience and higher brain functions, and he ends with some speculation about the future. So a wonderful broad look at the brain from the internal workings of a cell to very broad understandings of our consciousness. So I will leave a link in the show notes for that book.
And everybody, this is a great one to add to the library amongst those other ones. And jump into some of our courses on the brain, John Arden's course, some of sons that Matt do, the basic ones that Matt and I do. Just get yourself to know this stuff, because when you get more knowledge, you can become more creative. It's not about just getting knowledge and being restricted. It's about getting knowledge and being creative. So thanks to you, Matt. Thanks to John Dowling. Mm-hmm. Thanks to the universe, because we're still here and I appreciate that.
Okay, wonderful. Okay, well, thank you so much for everyone for joining us here on the Science of Psychotherapy podcast, and we'll catch you next week.
Bye for now. Thanks for listening to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. For more great science, go to thescienceofpsychotherapy.com.